This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
For every gangland criminal that you've heard of, there are plenty more flying under the radar whose names you wouldn't recognise, like David Waldron.
He really kept his head down, didn't really get involved in any gangland disputes, wasn't in the papers every second week the way some of them are, and didn't really attract a lot of Garda heat. And because of that, he was really able to quietly go about building up a fairly substantial drugs empire.
Last week, his 25-year run in the drugs trade was laid bare after losing a long-running battle with the Criminal Assets Bureau. Waldron's story extends beyond the criminal underworld. It features opulent properties, a so-called head shop czar, and a luxury funeral business his wife claimed to start up, called Elegant Send-Off.
She said she imported items from China. I suppose the funeral company was aimed at pimping up a funeral. I mean, it had equipment that would lower a coffin into a grave, you know, US style.
This is In the News from the Irish Times. I'm Sarah Hapalik. Today, how convicted drug dealer David Waldron led a luxury lifestyle until Cab kicked down the door. Conor Lally is the Irish Times crime and security editor. Conor, can I start by asking, who is David Waldron and how significant a player was he in the criminal underworld here in Dublin?
Well, I suppose David Waldron, to a lot of people who'll be tuned in today, they probably won't have heard of him until the last week or two. But really, he's been a significant player on the drug scene in Dublin for about 25 years. And his role, I suppose, really became quite senior from about 2010 onwards. Unlike some of the other people of his, you know, generation who've been involved in organised crime, they got drawn into things like gangland feuds. And then because of that, they end up in the newspapers quite a bit, and this just draws a lot of attention onto them. This guy, David Waldron, kept out of all of that. He really kept his head down, didn't really get involved in any gangland disputes, wasn't in the papers every second week the way some of them are, and didn't really attract a lot of Garda heat. And because of that, he was really able to quietly go about, you know, building up a fairly substantial drugs empire. As I say, he's been at it for a long time, about 25 years. He turns 48 later this year. So he's been at it since he was in his early 20s, but his role really jumped forward from about 2010 onwards.
I wanted to ask about that actually, because that was when Eamon Dunn died, right? So that kind of advanced Waldron's career in a way.
Yeah, so Eamon Dunn, people will probably know his name quite well. He was shot dead in a pub in Cabra in April 2010. Now, he was part of a drugs gang in the Finglas and Cabra areas. They really ran the drugs trade there. A guy called Marlo Hyland was the leader of that gang before Eamon Dunn. Marlo Hyland, again, went through this pattern of attracting a lot of Garda and press attention. And so many of his people were picked up by the guards and their drugs seized and so on, that his own men actually turned on him. They conspired against him and they killed him in a house in December 2006 in the Finglas area. Okay. So when Marlo Hyland was shot dead, Eamon Dunn took over control of the gang, and then he led that for about 3.5 years, during which time his group was linked to 16 or 17 gangland killings. And then finally, his reign was just seen as so violent and so bad for organised crime in the city that the Kinahans sanctioned his killing. And basically, he was killed in a pub in Cabra in an effort to calm everything down. And once Eamon Dunn was killed, this guy, David Waldron, really took up the mantle. He didn't quite take over Eamon Dunn's gang, but he certainly stepped into the primary, drugs wholesaling role in the Finglas and particularly Cabra areas when Dunn died. And he's been a much, as I say, quieter character than Eamon Dunn. He's gone about his trade in a very, you know, subdued, under-the-radar kind of way. And we've really only been hearing about him for the last kind of year and a half or so, and especially the last week or two when his case that was brought against the Criminal Assets Bureau concluded in the High Court.
You've written about the relentless rate of attrition in Dublin's drug trade, and there's name after name of people who were killed in the years when David Waldron was operating. Can you tell me a little bit more about people like David Kearns, Richard Keogh, Micka the Panda Kelly, people like that?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. When you look at David Waldron's, I suppose, peer group, you really get a sense of what gangland crime is all about. We've already spoken about the people who led the gang that David Waldron, you know, more or less took over from, Marlowe Highland and Eamon Dunn. They were both shot dead, you know, by their... Highland by his own gang, and then Eamon Dunn by the Kinahan cartel. And then if we look at other people, David Waldron was a close associate of a man called Richard Keogh. He was a 30-year-old from Cabra. He was very close to him, and at one stage he was even a co-director of a fairly shady car company that operated out of the South Inner City. Now look, the guards don't believe that did any trade as such. It was just more of a vehicle for organised crime, particularly laundering cash. So Richard Keogh had gone to Spain early in 2009. He was trying to meet up with South American drugs wholesalers there to, you know, in the hope that they would supply drugs to him and Waldron. And he was shot dead coming out of a pub on the Costa del Sol back in 2009. Michael Kelly then was an associate as well of David Waldron. He was known as the Panda, and he was shot dead in Clongriffin on the north side of Dublin in September 2011. The real IRA are believed to have killed him. They were trying to extort cash from him and other drugs gangs at the time. And when he was shot dead, as I say, they were the chief suspects there. Interestingly, Kelly's former partner is a woman called Cueva Robinson, and she's now Daniel Kinahan's wife. So, you know, there's a lot of connections there between all of these people in the underworld. David Douglas then, he was a 55-year-old who was shot in July 2016 as part of the Kinahan Hutch feud. He was also a close associate of David Waldron. So, you know, you have this... I suppose David Waldron saw what happened to these people that he knew, particularly people who clashed with other criminals, drew too much heat on them from all over the place. And when he got his hands, I suppose, on a prime piece of real estate for in terms of drug dealing in Cabra, he didn't go about his trade the way his predecessors had. He kept out of the limelight and he didn't clash with other people in the underworld.
So, Conor, let's talk about the past week. What did the Criminal Assets Bureau seize from Waldron this week?
So, essentially, what David Waldron did was he tried to build a property empire, and he, you know, he was kind of well on his way to doing that. He bought four properties. He still had three of them when the Criminal Assets Bureau began a major inquiry into him back in 2017. Back then, there were 24 searches carried out in various places all over Dublin, in Kildare and in County Wexford. So what Waldron basically did was he applied for mortgages really starting in the Celtic Tiger era. He would have bought his first house in the Finglas area in 2001. So he bought that property. And then he subsequently went on to apply for at least three other mortgages. Now, essentially what he did, when you applied for a mortgage, even during the Celtic Tiger era, obviously when, you know, lending practices were pretty lax, you had to, you know, supply things like P60s, wage slips, bank statements and all of that. He never had a job. You know, he never really had a proper job. He was definitely earning his income from drug dealing from his very early 20s. So what he simply did was he simply faked all the documentation that was required to get a mortgage. So literally everything, like correspondence from employers, as I say, P60s, wage slips, bank statements, all of that. And by just faking all these documents, he was able to create this, I suppose, paper trail of a person who was working in the car trade or was working as a tradesman. And he claimed in these documents that he was earning up to 80,000 euros a year. And really, as he continued to get mortgages for these properties, he would assure the banks that he was getting rental income from the previous house that he'd bought, that rental income was paying the mortgage on that property, and he was going to do the same again. You know, classic Celtic Tiger stuff. Only in his case, all the documents were forged and he was paying for everything through the proceeds of crime.
So, and he was claiming
unemployment
benefits. He was claiming unemployment payments at the time, and even this continued well into the pandemic period. He was actually claiming the pandemic unemployment payment at a time when the Criminal Assets Bureau was really stuck into him in a big way. I mean, the case at that stage was really well underway. He was claiming to the guards that he was unemployed, as I say, claiming these social welfare payments, and he was even looking for free legal aid from the High Court so he could fight the cab case. And at one stage, he was granted €8,000 because he essentially, him and his wife, Charlene Waldron, they fought the cab all the way, which is kind of unusual for these guys. And they wanted to put up a fight and argue that the money that they used to buy these properties was either provided, you know, through savings of social welfare, savings from jobs that they claimed they did, cash that they got from elderly people in their family and so on. So they were rewarded €8,000 of free legal aid to go and try and prove this. But shortly after they got that free legal aid, the guards realised that Waldron and his wife had actually spent €5,000 on a christening party for their child. You know, they had like a band and a DJ and so on. And they also bought a Land Rover for €23,000. Now, this is in the period when they're claiming to be unemployed and also claiming the pandemic unemployment payment. So they couldn't turn the bling lifestyle off when they really should have.
And when they were given this free legal aid, weren't they also living in this beautiful house out in Kildare?
They were living in this beautiful house. Actually, at that stage, they were in the house in County Wexford. So if I can go through these properties that I suppose cab took off them, I mean, the value of the properties combined, cab estimates, is over €3 million. So the first house Waldron bought in the Finglas area on Glenties Road was in 2001. He bought the house, he extended it, renovated it, and paid the mortgage on it. All of that paid through the proceeds of crime. Then he sold the house, and he made about 50,000 or 60,000 euros from that property. And then he sought to take that cash and then trade up. So then he bought a house in Cabra. He bought a house in a place called River Valley in Leixlip in County Kildare. And then he bought this quite a large property in County Wexford. And really, the property in County Wexford, I suppose, is the one that's grabbed all the headlines. It's called Darview Heights. It's a 3,000 square foot property. It looks like a single story property at the front, but it's on a sloping site, so it's three stories at the back. So it's got things like facilities for like ponies at the back. Him and his wife had ponies. It's got a bar, a gym, a pool room, and it was finished to a very high spec inside. You know, very, you know, marble countertops everywhere. You know, very large bathrooms, ensuite bathrooms, balconies off all of the rooms off the back of the house. So this is a kind of you know, people's dream holiday home down in County Wexford, a very large property. Now, Cab essentially tried to establish how much David Waldron spent on this house. And some of the estimates that the experts put together for Cab estimated that it was about €1.7 million. Now, the High Court didn't accept that it was that high because the High Court said that some of the work probably would have been done cash in hand, and they would have cut corners because of that. Probably a lot of the work wouldn't have had things like VAT applied to it. So the sum that the High Court believes at least €800,000 was actually spent on this house. Some of the other properties that Waldron bought, he bought a property in Cabra, and he spent €400,000 on it. Now, these are two up, two down former council houses. And he extended the house out the back, you know, very large two-storey extension out the back. He then put a kind of a second dwelling at the bottom of what was left of the garden, a kind of a granny flat type arrangement. And he rented out those two as separate properties. And it was the same in River Valley in Leixlip again. Hundreds of thousands of euros spent on it. His logic seemed to be that if he bought these houses and at the beginning he could show he had earnings from a previous property sale, he had fake documentation to show that he actually did have a job, and that's where his, you know, in inverted commas, savings came from. he seemed to think that Cab wouldn't be able to take these houses off him. Mm. He seemed to think that they wouldn't be able to untangle the cash that he then spent on the houses, extending them, renovating them and so on. But the Criminal Assets Bureau just did a painstaking job and went through everything in the house, got, you know, people like auctioneers in, engineers, quantity surveyors, and they just put an estimate on the value of all of the changes that Waldron made. And really, the Cab decided that over about a 15-year period, he spent between 3 million and 4 million euros on these properties. And this is at a time when he didn't ever have a job.
Coming up, a luxury funeral business and a headshot pioneer. How David Waldron's story extends beyond the drugs trade.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
You said that Cab began investigating him in 2017, but how did he stay under the radar for so long? Firstly, when so many around him were dropping like flies, yeah. But also he was spending all this cash.
I suppose it's kind of interesting. I mean, he did come to the attention of the guards for, you know, crimes here and there, and he spent some time in jail. And actually, Darren Kearns, one of the people who was killed, was trying to keep his drugs empire going when Waldron was in jail, and it was during that period that Kearns was actually shot dead. But I suppose for every person you see in the news, there's 10 or 20 other people who aren't in the papers and whose names you don't know. I mean, if you look at the drugs trade all over Ireland, you can get drugs in any town or, you know, village all over the country. So it's a huge industry now. And really, the percentage of drug dealers that come to public attention in any real way at any one time is fairly small. So really, there's lots of David Waldrons out there who nobody, bar maybe the people who live near them or who grew up with them, know who they are. Now, the unusual thing about him is that the Finglas and Cabra areas in particular have been very volatile drugs markets for the last 20, 25 years. I mean, I've probably written more stories about people being shot dead in those areas than any other part of Ireland. Mm. So the mystery, I suppose, is that he was able to keep a low profile operating in those areas. I mean, you'd keep a low profile operating in, you know, other parts of Ireland where there's not a very pronounced gun feuding culture. He was very astute at, I suppose, taking one step back from street level drug dealing and street level feud violence. And he would do things like, you know, take drugs from offshore, including from the Kinahan cartel. Once he got his hands on them, he would then be a wholesaler to smaller street-level gangs in Finglas and Cabra. And really, they were the people who were engaging in the violence on the streets. They were attracting all the guard attention.
I also have to ask about his wife, Charlene. How does she fit into all of this? And she has a history within her own family as well, right?
She does have a history in her own family. I mean, the interesting thing about Charlene Waldron is that during the Criminal Assets Bureau case, she sought to have herself included in the case. So she essentially tried to claim that this big 3,000 square foot house down in County Wexford was her family home. And sometimes in these Cab cases, when a house is, you know, judged a family home by the court, a partner and children are allowed to stay there. They are allowed to even keep that home. But really, in this particular case, that house was like the prized item in the Criminal Assets Bureau case. So I don't think that was really ever going to happen here. But her grand uncle is a guy called James Bellamy, who was essentially ran adult shops in various parts of Ireland for years. And then when the head shop craze took off, people will recall that these head shops were able to sell, you know, legal highs for a period of years. He was one of the first people to really cotton on to how lucrative head shops could be. When one of his head shops went on fire one time, he told the guards that he had over 400,000 euros in cash in the shop and that was lost. And the guards are inclined to believe that that's true. So Charlene Waldron describes him as her granduncle. At one stage, Charlene Waldron began a funeral company, or at least she claimed she did. And she said she imported items from China. And this was, I suppose, the funeral company was aimed at, you know, pimping up a funeral. I mean, it had equipment that would lower a coffin into a grave. You know, you know, US style fancy funeral kind of operation.
It was called funerals.
Elegant Send Off.
Send Off, okay.
Elegant Send Off. And she also bought equipment that would decorate people's homes for wakes. So this idea was that you could make the funeral very fancy and very elegant, okay? So she claims she started this company and she claims it went really well, and then she sold it to her granduncle, James Bellamy, the former head shop czar, and she claimed that she got 200,000 euros from him for the company. Now, the Criminal Assets Bureau don't accept that that's true. They don't believe that this company was trading in any real way. They certainly don't think it was valued at anything close to 200,000 euros. And they think this was a ruse in order that Waldron could produce 200 grand and say this is from a, you know, legal sound, you know, source. But the cabinet didn't accept that. Charlene Waldron then also said she'd various other kind of commercial interests, which were small time things like, you know, makeover services and nail, you know, do your nails and all that kind of stuff. But again, the guards didn't really believe that that was, that she would get an income from those that would enable the Waldrons to live the lifestyle that they clearly were. And she didn't hide it. I mean, she blasted it all over social media. You can even get a fairly good idea as to where they went on their holidays and who they were with by flicking through her social media pictures.
So in stark contrast to her husband.
Absolutely. And the curious thing about that is, even, like, as I say, this Criminal Assets Bureau case has been going on in the courts for 4 years, but it began, you know, a long time before that. And even during that period of time, even when they were applying for things like, you know, legal aid to try and fight CAB in the High Court, she was continuing to post these pictures. So a lot of these people, I suppose, get hooked on the lifestyle and projecting this image of flying all over Europe to these sun holiday spots, bringing lots of their family members and their friends there, driving around in the big car, having the big house, fancy clothes, getting their hair done all the time. And when the Criminal Assets Bureau was knocking on their door, telling them, we're calling time on you now, doing all of this, they just can't stop.
Conor, on a somewhat unrelated note, but still connected to Irish organised crime, we learned this week that Gardaí, targeting feuding criminal gangs, had seized a pump-action shotgun, but for the second time. The first time it was seized was in 2009, and records showed it was supposed to still be in Garda secure storage. Could this signify corruption within Garda ranks?
I mean, the short answer to that question is that yes, it could. I mean, we don't know yet. There's a Garda inquiry into this incident. I mean, it's a really serious incident. A pump action shotgun is a lethal weapon. And when it's in the hands of organised crime, that's bad for everybody, obviously. So this pump action shotgun was previously owned by a man who sold firearms. So he held this gun, you know, legally. It was stolen during a burglary on his premises back in 2004. It wasn't recovered at the time, but there was a Garda inquiry into the burglary. 5 years later, in a completely unrelated Garda operation on the east of the country, this gun was seized, and when it was analysed, Gardaí realised it was the same firearm that had been stolen in the burglary 5 years earlier. So from the time it was seized from organised crime in 2009, it should have been in the Garda's secure evidence system, where everything is bagged and tagged, everything has a barcode and is under lock and key in these storage units all over the country that are controlled by the guards. But last year, again in a completely unrelated organised crime operation, the Gardaí seized the pump-action shotgun from feuding criminals. And when they examined it, they realised this was the gun they'd seized back in 2009, and which essentially should have been under lock and key in a Garda stores. So somehow this, you know, lethal firearm found its way out of Garda care, if you like, and back into the hands of organised crime. So there's a major Garda investigation going on into that. Drew Harris has sent a report about it to Helen McEntee and to the policing authority just to explain, you know, that this has happened. The Garda inquiry hasn't concluded yet, so we don't know exactly how this gun ended up back on the streets. But it's a disaster for the guards. And certainly one avenue being explored is the possibility that somebody in An Garda Síochána Síochána or working for An Garda Síochána Síochána was involved in this whole incident. So it is quite serious.
Conor Lally, thanks so much for your time today. That's all for today. For more of Conor Lally's exclusive stories and analysis, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Saoirse Pollock. This episode was produced by Declan Conlon and Aideen Finnegan. In the News, we'll be back tomorrow.